Welcome to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability. Your hosts are Bill Reed and John Becker, co-authors of the Integrative Design Guide to Green Building. This program will help you take sustainability to the next level. Here are your hosts, Bill Reed and John Becker.
Welcome back, everyone. You're with Bill Reed and John Becker on Building Deeper Green. And today we are moving into our seventh episode, and our topic for the day is materials. And specifically, a question is the title of the show is Life Cycle Assessment the Holy Grail? So we want to talk about that a little bit, but we really want to understand what are the underlying principles, ideas, and full implications of material selections in the built environment.
Well, yeah, well, let's back up a little bit, Sean, on this. The materials have often been seen as what green design is all about. It's recycling, it's post-used materials, if you will. What's the geez?
Reused or salvaged materials.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And when people look at pictures of buildings and what you see in the signs and with sustainability programs of buildings, people are pointing out all the materials. And it generally looks as if that's the big issue with sustainability. Of course, we know there's energy and there's water. But materials have always been seen from the architects and the engineers' domain as their particular provenance. So one of the contrarian perspectives that I bring to this, and it irritates people sometimes, but I'll start off the show with that anyway, is that what's the big deal with materials? They don't go away. They don't disappear. You know, people say, well, we're going to lose all the materials. We're going to lose our resources. Well, unless we burn them, they don't go away. They just change in value. They change in substance, and they can be changed back again. Of course, that's the question.
How the problem is we do burn.
What's that? We do burn. Yes, you're right. We are burning them, and that is the problem. And so, in general, the law of conservation of mass and energy says materials don't go away, and they change to energy, perhaps. And so, really, the conversation is not about loss of materials. It's how we have reshaped their value and devalued them to the point where we're poisoning ourselves, we're polluting the rivers, we are creating new substances out of the materials so they can never be used again in a more effective way. So the material discussion gets much more rich than simply saying recycle or that it's all about materials. It actually is much more complex. And that's the reason we're talking about this today.
That's actually a really good segue into what LCA is. So LCA,
hey, what else,
in some ways...
Say more about that, John.
Well, life cycle assessment is really about taking a look at all the impacts that materials have from what's commonly referred to as cradle to grave, right? So let's just pick concrete. So concrete has five things in it, right? It's got water, sand, gravel, cement, and usually some sort of cement displacement like fly ash. Well, to make the cement, just one piece of that concrete, you need to mine limestone from the earth, melt it in a 1700-degree blast furnace kiln, create clinkers that are then pulverized into powder that becomes cement to which you add water, sand, and gravel, and over a couple of weeks via the heat of hydration you have concrete. Well, the process of LCA would look at mining that limestone from the earth. What did it take to do that? What are all the flows into the environment, such as the internal combustion engine used on the machinery to mine it and the emissions associated with that, and what are all the flows from the environment, for example, the limestone itself, then transporting that to the cement plant, then all the impacts across maybe 13 different impact areas to create the cement itself, then transporting that to the concrete batch plant, then actually creating the concrete, transporting that to the site, installing it, maintaining it over its useful life, and then at the end of its useful life, what happens to it? Is it recycled or is it
chopped up for aggregate?
Or maybe even sometimes sent to landfill, which would be unusual these days. But every one of those processes just outlined has impacts, again, flows from the environment and flows into, usually across somewhere in the order of a dozen or more environmental impact indicators, such as embodied energy or CO2 emissions and human toxicity and other toxicities, water waste and water pollution, etc.
So it gets pretty darn complicated.
Yeah, and every one of those things can be quantified. So, Bill, yeah, it gets really complicated because that's just one component of the thousands and thousands of things we have in a building.
And we have to do that for every material if we're going to get a handle on it.
So what you can see is, in some ways, Bill, we are burning materials even in that process. We had to burn the limestone to get the cement, right?
Sure, and any manufacturing process generally has energy applied to it.
Yeah, so right there you can see immediately that what we're talking about here is trying to bring us back at least partially into the whole to see how materials are impacting our other four or other three key subsystems, energy, like Bill just mentioned, big water component, and habitat, such as eutrophication. And
look at West Virginia, for instance. People say, well, what do resources have to do with global climate change or sustainability? Well, if you look at pictures of the current mining processes in West Virginia, where they're literally stripping mountaintops off and throwing the mountaintops in the valley, and the orange sludge that's coming out of, not only have they killed the habitat in those valleys, they polluted all the waterways downstream. So it's our selection of materials, the energy used to produce those materials, has tremendous downstream impact on the core competencies, if you will, the planet, the health of the habitat, and the quality of water.
But there's good news and bad news, I think, with this LCA stuff. I mean, on the one hand, we think, all right, look, generally when as architects, we select materials, we're thinking about, all right, what's their durability, their cost, and their aesthetics. So this is actually running it through another filter of environmental impacts. So generally speaking, one might think that because these impacts are being quantified, that we are now making objective decisions. Well, unfortunately, that's not quite the case, because there are so many materials that might have very minimal impacts, let's say, on human toxicity, but huge impacts on eutrophication, right? And maybe
define eutrophication.
I'm sorry. Eutrophication would be the over-concentration of nitrogen in our water sources, which becomes really dessert or food for algae. Hence, we have algae blooms that suck up all the oxygen out of the water and pretty much kill everything else. And then they exceed the carrying capacity of that ecosystem and die, further adding toxins to the water and pretty much creating dead zones like several miles out into the Gulf of Mexico.
Yep. And just as a sidebar, what we typically do as a society is we further poison the ponds to kill the algae so the eutrophication doesn't happen.
Where's all that coming from? The nitrogen, where's that coming from?
Right. Well, where do you think? Okay, so where is it coming from? Let's just be graphic about it. For people walking their pets, dog poop, bad septic systems, agricultural over-fertilization.
Oh, that's the big one, right?
Well, it's all over. I mean, you know, it's even big if you don't have agriculture, you've got people fertilizing their lawns and walking their dogs. Dog population is a big problem.
Yeah, that was Jerry Wilhelm talking about the drug-dependent rug sitting on a bed of clay, right? The turf grass?
Yeah, that we mow every week.
Yeah.
So, okay, well,
there you have it. So I think what we want to try and talk to Scott about, and we have Scott Horst joining us here in a moment, who's worked with these issues for many, many years, is this really an objective way for us to select materials? Because, you know, let's just look at, well, first of all, LCA in and of itself is not useful unless you're using it to compare impacts between material selections. At that point, then, you're faced with what's important to you. So, again, you may have one material like VCT that has really significant toxicity impacts and compare it to linoleum that doesn't, other than really big eutrophication impacts. So what do you pick?
Yeah, and so can it be summarized in one simple number?
Ooh, well, let's ask that question. Yeah, so let's welcome Scott Horst. Scott, are you there with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, we have that question we want to ask you, if you heard it, but before we do that, let's just find out what you do. What do you do right now?
Well, right now I'm Senior Vice President for LEED at the U.S. Green Building Council, so I'm really, from the staff side, running the LEED program. Which is very exciting and challenging. And prior to doing this, I was a partner with you guys.
Yeah, partner in 7 Group. We miss you, brother.
Yeah, I miss you guys too.
So anyway, we want you to tell us your story, but we have this burning question, and that is, Bill's question is a really good one, and that is, with all these different environmental impacts that are quantified in LCA, can you reduce it to one number?
Right. So
He's equivocating already.
Yeah. Well, can you reduce it? No, of course you cannot reduce it to one number. But what you and LCA actually isn't trying to get you to reduce it to one number either. It's actually trying to get you to be able to make a more informed decision, and it's trying to help change the decision-making model. So if you think of, like, Bill, the way you introduced it, you know, we think of materials in the most rudimentary and kind of unprofound way by thinking of the attributes that are kind of the outcome of something that occurs, like recycled content. And we think that way because we know that back when we started doing recycling, I mean, if you just think through the thought process of why we care so much about that, people like us that really cared about the environment saw lots of great stuff getting thrown away, so they started recycling programs. They saw that they had lots of landfills close to where people lived, and they realized they could help solve a number of problems by creating these programs. But then what happened was they were so successful that there was so much material that no one was using that material that the market started fading for recycled materials. So in the early 80s, I think it was, you know, people were starting to say, no sense in recycling if you don't buy recycled content. So what, you know, that way of thinking about it sort of helped create that market for changing materials from that perspective, but it didn't really give us a strong sense of how we can start to think about materials and make really complex choices. LCA helps make complex choices because it simply starts to point out that solid waste, or what you deal with recycling, is only one of many issues that are actually occurring in the environment when you're tracking the flow of a material or product as it comes from nature and goes back to nature.
Well, Scott, we're barely getting communities to pick up recycling or citizens and communities to offer recycled products for curbside pickup. And now we're talking about many levels of issues that need to be addressed. Are you finding communities or architects and engineers beginning to pick up on the greater complexity?
I think, you know, the question is kind of like this, Bill. Like, I read a report recently that showed that the nutrition label, even though we have nutrition labels on our food, that actually shows a very complex amount of information that obesity has not changed in America since we started using nutrition labels. However, I make a lot of choices about what I eat based on those labels. So it does allow people that want to be informed about the choices that they make to make those types of decisions in a different way.
Right. So if you have a problem with sodium, you pick products that have less sodium. If you're a diabetic, less grams of carbohydrates, et cetera, right?
Right. And LCA allows you to start to make those kinds of decisions that way because it can give you that kind of information.
So give us an example of how someone making a decision about a material could be informed in their choice by some LCA data.
Okay. So let's say you had a study. Well, there are a lot of ways, and it really depends on where you're approaching the question from. So if you're an architect and you are making a decision there are a lot of decisions you're making as a designer. You might be making a decision based on, let's say, column and bay sizing, or you might be making a decision on whether or not you want to use concrete columns and steel beams or possibly even glue lamp beams.
Well, Scott, I need to interrupt you right there because we have to go to break. But let's pick it up right there when we come back, because I think that's a really useful path we're treading here. So, folks, we'll be back in just a minute. Take a short break and continue with our guest, Scott Horst from the U.S. Green Building Council.
Are you a wildfire survivor? Do you need help but don't know where to turn? SoCalHelp.org is a place you can go to get immediate help with food, shelter, important medications, and start getting your life back on track. Get help now with insurance, legal issues, and find professional help like doctors and counselors. You can also connect with other survivors and people who can help. For the answers and support you need to rebuild, visit SoCalHelp.org.
Many designers are adapting their design process. They are developing methods to address the environmental impact of their work. Graphic, industrial, interior, architectural, landscape, identity, and fashion designers share a common experience. By revealing the thought processes of people from a wide range of design disciplines, your understanding of sustainable design strategies will deepen. Join us every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, for Design Evolution on the Green Talk Network.
America is facing a skilled workforce shortage. SkillsUSA can help. What is SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA is life-changing.
SkillsUSA is awesome.
SkillsUSA is one of the biggest opportunities life can give you.
SkillsUSA is amazing.
SkillsUSA is motivating.
SkillsUSA specifically prepares you for the workforce.
SkillsUSA empowers students to connect with a network of people, starting with their classmates, to their advisors, to other people in their states. SkillsUSA allows students to connect with business and industry, to manage their education, and to really get a feel of the real world. I'm doing something now that's going to be applicable in the real world, and those skills are going to be useful today in school and in 5 years when I'm working and for the rest of my life.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at skillsusa.org.
At the Green Talk Network, our experts want to hear your voice. Do you have a question or comment for our hosts? Call us toll-free, 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Building Deeper Green, everybody, with John Becker and Bill Reed and our guest, Scott Horst. And, John, why don't you pick up the conversation you were having with Scott?
Oh, he had asked Scott the question about how data derived from life cycle assessment can help influence decision making from designers when they're building. And Scott, you were telling us about maybe making decisions about concrete or steel or base spacing. So how can LCA help with those?
Yeah, so the way it can help is the designer is usually making a series of decisions based on what's important to them. Now, if you could have the information in front of you in a relatively easy format and know that a study was of a high quality where there was a comparison between, let's say, glue lamp beams and an alternative choice, which might be steel, you would see that the overall impact, and that's, let's say, across six different categories, could be significantly less if you went with the wood option.
Or you could, let's say, just look at CO2 emissions, right?
Right, or you could say, what matters to me the most is CO2, so today I'm going to make my choices about my building based on CO2, and you can easily get those numbers. Now, can I go back to the question that Bill had asked at the very beginning of the show?
Yeah.
So, Bill, why do materials matter? Let me just give you a sense. It's a good question because if you were to look at a pie chart over a 60-year lifespan, the impacts, let's say just from a global warming potential perspective, just from a CO2 perspective, the impacts of the materials might be 8%, 8 to 14%.
Of a typical building's lifespan over 60 years?
Yes.
Wait. So 8 to 14% of carbon impact?
Yeah, of the overall carbon impact of that building, given all the things that are occurring in the operations of the building.
Except over a 30-year lifespan, let's say.
But that's just for operations. That's not for fabricating or disposing of those materials, right?
Correct. It's basically saying the materials are there. Their impact occurred at the beginning of the building, but then the building's impact occurred over the 60 years.
Okay, 60 years. All right.
So but operations impacts like, you know, running chillers and boilers and ventilation fans.
Yeah, but Scott's comparing the impact of the production of those materials.
No, he's just talking about, I think, the impacts associated with maintaining and operating the building, like waxing the floor, that would keep the material in place. Right, Scott?
Well, it includes that, but actually even given all of that, the impact of the materials in the studies that we had done before at Athena Institute, you know, where I was, the 8-14% would include all of the production, the extraction, manufacturing, use of those materials.
And installation.
Yep.
And maintenance. So 8-14% of all the CO2 impacts.
Of that building over 60 years.
Okay.
And the only thing we're taking out of this is transportation of the people going to and from the building.
Okay.
So that's a significant impact. I mean, it looks over the life of the building like it's not that much, 8-14%, who cares? But on day one, it's the full impact of the building, right? And so it goes down to 8-14% over the 60 years. What you want to be doing is optimizing both. Like, instead of saying, well, materials aren't that big of a deal because the energy overwhelms it over the lifespan of the building, you want to be able to say, we can actually optimize both those things because the energy and the carbon emitted from the materials is an ongoing, constant manufacturing thing that's occurring. And if you're just looking at energy alone, I mean, just the carbon alone, if you think that it's only about energy, you're wrong, because almost all of the toxicants that we have in our environment are coming from the manufacture of materials.
That's the burning and the burning process, if you will, the transformation of material into something else, right, Scott?
Yes, it's that, and it's also the complicated nature of our materials today. The fact that we're so good at creating new chemicals and things that we don't know what they're going to do once they're in the environment.
Yeah, we have the connection back to habitat again, in terms of these four key subsystems. But, you know, you said something really interesting there, Scott. You said you wanted to optimize both the impacts of the materials and that of the building.
Right.
So is this one of the reasons why I hear you talk so much about building service life?
Yes.
Can you say more about that, please?
Yeah, see, if this is, to me, one of the lost opportunities, but it's one of the things that I think we all enjoyed talking about in the book, which is, our ancestors did not think of buildings relative to a lifespan, unless they were nomadic. They built things to last. Now, we build things, and usually, if you go into any design meeting, almost any architect or design team that hasn't thought this through very well will say, 50-60-year lifespan is what we're building this for.
Often referred to as building service life, right?
Right. But if you very intentionally approach that question, instead of just sort of throwing it off, you'd completely change your material choices.
Give me an example.
So a project we worked on for an institution, this is a while back, they said, and they could say this kind of thing because they're an institution, they said, we want this building to last 300 years. So every choice then was about making sure that the materials that were chosen and the materials that were chosen for how they would fit together would last as long as possible.
Okay, so that was an intentional and serious choice. That wasn't said in a cavalier way.
Correct.
Okay.
And now let's take a study we did at the Athena Institute some time ago, where we studied all the buildings that had been torn down in St. Paul, Minnesota over a one-year span. And we went back and looked to see why were they being torn down. We sent out a survey, basically, and one of the fascinating things we found out of that was that the buildings that had the most durable materials, the what we usually refer as durable, like brick, they were made out of brick, steel, and concrete, were buildings that lasted the shortest amount of time.
Why?
Because they were being used for strip malls. And so there's a way that we develop buildings in patterns that usually
strip malls run out of fashion, in a sense, right?
Yeah, they just don't last that long. They usually have about a 20-year lifespan.
And they redecorate them every 7 years anyway.
So if we were really thinking about that, we wouldn't make our strip malls out of such durable materials.
Right. They should be made out of materials. So you want to associate the material with the intended service life.
By the way, what was the material to build a 300-year building?
There was a lot of stone. It was basically, the building was built the way a lot of the other buildings on that campus were built, which was, you know, a lot of stone. Of course, there was significant concrete, but there was a lot of attention paid to make sure that, I mean, normally what fails in concrete over time is the steel, so there was attention paid to make sure that those connections were extremely taken care of, so in 100 years someone wasn't going to have to be dealing with them. But yeah, a lot of solid materials that they knew were going to last forever. And with a focus on that issue of, it's called differential durability, any material is only as durable as the weakest point in the collection of materials that put the assembly together.
So like the durability of a window is the seal around where the glass meets the frame, for example.
Yep, if the seal breaks in 30 years but the glass could last 200 years, then it's a 30-year window.
Yeah, and the other problem with concrete, you see a lot of spalling from rebar expansion, but that's a seal of water penetration into the concrete then.
So, yeah, that's a complicated one.
It is. Well, then on the other side of it, though, there are other designers that are working on, in fact, one great example that we know of is the Chartwell School out in Monterey, or Seaside, California, nearby Monterey, where the school itself was designed to be literally deconstructible at the end of its useful life, thinking that they would likely be reconfiguring it based on different populations, et cetera.
Yeah, that's really neat.
Yeah, now, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I mean, see, so just before I go there, John, like the cool thing about all this is that LCA allows this, it helps with this discussion because it helps you guide which direction you're heading. So it's not really about
the... It doesn't give you an answer. It's a guide.
Exactly.
Oh, now that's a really key discovery. Okay, so when we ask the question, is it the Holy Grail? Well, what are you looking for, right?
Yeah.
You define
the
Holy Grail.
It's not... The point is that materials are so complex, it means what it helps us do is change the way we make decisions because, like, the way I think about it, there's one really complex decision I make every day. It's what clothes am I going to get put on?
And how complex is that?
I know, but, yeah. but I make very few other decisions that are that complex. That decision I make based on a series of external factors, which are what's the weather today, am I going to be sitting in a car, am I sitting in an office, am I meeting with people, a whole variety of different things, and then I pick out what's in front of me based on things that I put into my closet.
No wonder I stand in front of the closet for so long.
But see, choosing materials should be that kind of decision. And the way we've set it up now as environmentalists is we've set it up so there's good and there's bad.
Oh, it's reductionist thinking again, right?
Right. And if I were to say in my closet I have good and bad, I would never choose the bad ones.
Put them in your closet.
Yeah, I've chosen things in the closet that I think are good. So I've already filtered. And then...
So it comes down that it's not just simply reductionist thinking. We don't even understand why we need to be thinking.
Yeah.
So we don't take the time in the design process.
Well, the reason I said reductionist thinking is because when we look at a lot of our rating systems as they currently are in their transformative mode, it reduces decisions about materials to things like recycled content, manufacturing, rapidly renewable, and salvage material content, right?
So
right.
At least when we're saying LCA is the Holy Grail, it's the Holy Grail for selecting materials, not for green design.
Right, and it's the Holy Grail for providing guidance for selecting materials, because the aha moment I've had in this conversation is that it's clearly not the answer. It's only a guide towards helping us make decisions based on the criteria for that particular project.
Yes. Yeah, and the really cool thing about it, what I really like about it is that, and you guys, I think, would really like this, but... It's often referred to as a scientific methodology for holistic thinking.
Yeah, nice.
That's very nice. So, say more about that, because it does tie back into really what the theme of this show is about, the whole.
Yeah, because essentially what you're saying is that that an impact, like I have a material in front of me, it's a piece of wood, and this piece of wood came from a tree. Oops, I just dropped it. And there are all these different things that occur that, you know, from, as you were pointing out at the beginning of the show, that occur from its extraction to wherever it ends up going when I'm done with it or when someone's done with it, maybe my grandchildren's children. But someday it will disintegrate again, and you want to be able to have an understanding of what all those impacts are so you can compare them one against the other. It's simply saying My materials choices are not made in a vacuum. I'm always choosing against something else.
So in other words, the true function of LCA is helping make comparative choices.
Yes.
Not a yes, no, good, bad kind of dualistic approach.
Well, which is similar to choosing energy, SEER requirements on appliances. That's a very simple example. Are we ever going to have that opportunity for the consumer, Scott, to have this choice menu similar to food products?
Or like the labels on food products?
Well, LCA allows that, and it's actually called a Type 3 label in ISO 14040. It's actually ISO 14025.
Okay, explain what ISO is, just quickly, yeah, before the break.
ISO is the International Organization of Standardization. It's a standardization body, and there's a particular standard about life cycle assessment, and there's a label that there's a standard about, which is essentially like a nutrition label for materials.
Okay. Well, we have to take a break, and we'll be back in a moment here, continuing our discussion with Scott Horst about materials. And Scott is the Senior Vice President in charge of LEED for the U.S. Green Building Council. Back in a minute.
What can you tell me about SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA teaches you employability skills. So you know how to deal with people, you have teamwork, your resume is going to look awesome.
Well, it's important to know your technical skills, but not only that, to have soft skills, the skills of learning how to communicate with people.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at skillsusa.org.
Can we recognize our world not as a commodity, but as a sacred creation that will support us best the more creatively we live on it? Green Visions is all about how a spirit of innovation and pleasure can be brought into solving our environmental problems. Join your host, Carolyn North, each week as she talks about what citizens of the world are doing to make a difference. Heal the planet, heal yourself, and have a good time doing it. Tune in to Green Visions with Carolyn North every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Green Talk Network.
Hey y'all, this is Stephen Cochran. As a country artist, I have traveled around this great country of ours, often meeting our brave men and women in uniform. And as a Marine and veteran of both the Iraq and Afghan conflict, I know how important it is to thank our troops who defend our freedom each and every day. One of the best ways to thank them is to give their children and spouses the gift of education. Scholarships for 2 years, 4 years, and vocational school. This is exactly what a national charity, Thanks USA, does. Please go to their website, www.thanksusa.org, to make a generous donation to the Thanks USA Scholarship Fund for the families of the troops, and I thank you.
Keep listening to the Green Talk Network for the latest in the sustainability and green movement for all of our futures, today and tomorrow. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now back to our program.
Here we are again with Building Deeper Green with Bill Reed, John Becker, and our guest Scott Horst from the U.S. Green Building Council. And we're talking with Scott about material issues, and particularly how we evaluate materials, life cycle assessment. And for those of you who may not be in the esoteric realm of building construction, and that includes us too, because even though we're architects, we have to shop for our products for our homes, and we have to deal with residential designers and contractors. Scott, is there any way that this work is going to be, moving from the label discussion, how is it going to get translated into daily practice and daily understanding by the consumer?
Well, I think there are multiple ways that it will happen over time. I mean, part of, I think, just our whole thinking now about what it means to rebuild or what it means to build and develop has a lot to do with how we're rebuilding. So we've tended to think in the past that it means not doing something, and now I think we're saying, no, let's just do it we can do it. Nature is always building. We can continue to build in that way. So LCA, from a scientific perspective, will help us understand how we can better meld with nature. But from a simple, like, human, and that'll lead us in a lot of directions from a meta perspective, Bill.
Whoa, I just had a thought. That's what just struck me was, for example, the Native Americans gathering wood in the forest to help keep the health of the trees and the forest floor daylighted for their brothers and sisters to grow. Actually, using those materials as building materials were actually contributing to the health of the forest.
Yeah, like that's ultimately what we want to be thinking. It's sort of like, it's like a diagnostic tool. Like, are we heading in the right direction? But I think there are a lot of simpler ways to think from a life cycle perspective, and you could just call it life cycle thinking. So if you're at home and you need to make a decision, you might just start training yourself to think, how many links in a chain probably occurred to make something happen, to get this thing to my door? And you can add up those links, as many as you can think, and when you start to get good at it, you see some of them have lots of links and some of them have just a few.
Oh, I love that. It's kind of like that diagram of how do you get an egg, right? There's this diagram that's 4 pages long, right? When all you really need is a chicken at your neighbor's house, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All the steel manufacturing, the manufacturing of the barn, and shipping the fertilizer, et cetera.
Fertilizer, and then the trucks, and that, oh, man. So anyway, keep going, sorry.
Yeah, so the shorter the chain, the better the material, I guess.
Hmm. Wow. Never thought about it that way.
But how as a consumer will we know this when, let's say, we go to Home Depot to buy 2x4s to build our deck?
Well, what you'll start seeing, hopefully, at places like Home Depot are something called, the things I really want to work on is what are called environmental product declarations. So, and it's happening a lot in Europe, and I suspect it's going to happen a lot here very soon, where companies will have to declare what the impacts are in a specific set of categories. So that information will travel with the material. So that immediately starts to totally transform the kind of information we're seeing. So we're basically seeing, like, the links in the chain, allowing me to make a more informed choice if I'd rather pick, this type of wood over that type of wood or whatever.
Well, you just said something, two things there that really struck me. One is there was something that you really said you wanted to work on, and two, you wanted to work on it in a transformative way, which helped transform the marketplace, which leads me to ask, how did you get started with all this? I mean, many folks know that you started off as a professional opera singer, and how did you get from there to this incredible level of expertise you have about materials?
I'm not sure you want this answer.
Yeah, well, no, I think we do.
Okay. Well,
we'll throw a stick in your spokes if it's too long, Scott.
Okay. So I went to music school but also got a degree in philosophy, and after singing professionally for about 7 years, I decided to that it was just a little too challenging of a life with two children and two mortgages, I basically started my own little studio furniture company because I had been doing carpentry a lot in my life and working in wood shops along the way. And that led to working with environmental materials. And, John, I think it was actually at a meeting where I met you where I got pulled into this, because it was for the DEP building that you designed that ultimately turned into one of the first lead pilot projects.
I remember that meeting very well. It was December of 1995.
So my sixth grade Sunday school teacher in Minnesota had come up with this environmental material that I was using to make furniture, and I brought it to that.
What was the material?
It was Environ Biocomposites, or Phoenix Biocomposites.
Oh, made of soybeans and recycled paper and...
Sunflower, wasn't it?
No, that was Dakota Burl. This was the soybean mash and recycled paper that she had cooked in her oven.
Huh. Yep. And essentially, it was actually, that's a cool story about that group actually sometime, but that created that company, because they created a series of environmental companies that had varying success during a time when people weren't very interested in the issues. But that that particular meeting ultimately led to a consulting contract with the state about bio-based materials that then connected to the federal government through a group called the Civil Engineering Research Foundation and USDA, and started my consulting company. I closed the shop after a while, and then as a consultant, I felt I really needed to differentiate myself by a type of knowledge, so I really focused on cement and bio-based materials and then life cycle assessment when I connected with the Athena Institute.
Yeah, to say a little about the Athena Institute, Scott.
Well, Athena is a group in Canada, and they had been doing this kind of thinking way in advance of everybody else. So they've been doing life cycle assessment studies for about 14 years now, and have a software tool. And Wayne Trustee, who runs the Institute, was essentially starting a project called the Life Cycle Inventory Database Project, which is kind of, it's like a free public library of data, because one of the huge problems with life cycle assessment is data. And
right, because a lot of it's also proprietary information, right?
Exactly, and very costly to collect. And so the Department of National Renewable Energy Labs, you know, at the Department of Energy, eventually took on the project, and they needed a U.S. nonprofit, and I became that nonprofit.
So, Scott, let me just make a general statement, just for, because generalities can get you in trouble, so it may inspire us to into a little conversation. Steel, concrete, and wood, those are the predominant building materials on our, in our culture in the Western Hemisphere. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And so by far, in general, wood is considered to have the lowest embodied energy. But is it the best to use?
Wood, the interesting thing from an LCA perspective is that wood always looks the best. But what there, this is important to understand. There's certain things that LCA does not do for us, it cannot do well. It does not measure land use impacts. So when you're going in and destroying habitat or, you know, clear-cutting woods, you are not, it's very difficult to measure those impacts. But you can measure everything else.
I just wanted, this is really an important point. And it's what we do in our culture in general. We try to, this is a broad statement, not just about LCA, but we try to measure little pieces and fragments and think that we have an understanding of it.
Well,
never do.
But this ties so beautifully back into a discussion of the whole then, right? Because if, in fact, that does enter the discussion when we're thinking about materials, then we can start to have a habitat play a role in our decision-making. And it really becomes about then, if wood is your choice, going one step further and looking at the husbandry, if you will, and the forest management practices to help contribute to the health of that forest.
That's right. But so there's not a number on it. It's a process.
That's
a practice. And
right.
So our need is to have none of these issues can stand alone. We can't say, well, I'm an expert in LCA, therefore I know all about materials. We have to know about many more things, and the design process is a discovery process for us to gather that information, not just information, but that understanding.
So, Scott, the LCA tool you were just talking about becomes just another tool in our quiver of analysis processes, so, such as the Athena tool, right?
Absolutely. And it's really just saying, you know, it's just saying that there's it's basically pointing out the complexity that's involved in the choices, which basically means if you're the type of person that cares about those complexities, then you're probably the type of person that cares about who you are on this earth, then you're probably going to want to know more than less.
Yeah.
And that's really all it is. It's not the Holy Grail. It's not the answer. The answer is in how you make choices. From my perspective, the answer is, what do you do when you stand in front of your own closet?
Yeah, well, the answer is, do you want to make the choice in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
So
LCA, then, just to reiterate, is a guide in helping us make that choice, but there's a whole bunch of other stimulus or sources that we should be looking at as well, beyond just the data.
Well, yeah, and ultimately, here's the really important thing. You cannot abdicate your responsibility as a decision maker to say what's most important to you. So LCA helps you make those decisions because you're given a choice, basically. One material is going to have a much greater impact on water, and the other one's going to have a much greater impact on CO2. So it's not really about you deciding which one is better or worse.
Hey, Scott, let's hold that because I want to talk. When we get back, I want to talk about what's important to you. That statement is really important. And so we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Scott Horst. John and I will be back with Scott Horst in a minute.
Attention swimmers, get out of the water. Everybody, out of the water immediately.
Dude, is that... It's a pair of thunder thighs. Big ones, too. That mom who's been swimming a lot with her kids must have lost them.
Whoa. I heard about this happening once up at Laguna.
Small step number 54. Play with your kids. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Are you thinking green? How do you make your home, family, and life green? Green Today with host Nelson Martinez aims to answer these questions and more. Look to the show as your guide to everything green, from the global movement to what's going on in your neighborhood. We can all do a little something to help our local environments and the planet as a whole by being smarter consumers and using products that are less harmful. Listen for Green Today with Nelson Martinez, Mondays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on the Green Talk Network.
In the great scheme of things, a minute isn't all that much, unless you happen to have a stroke. All of a sudden, those minutes count, minutes that could mean losing your ability to talk, move, or walk, which is why, if you can get help in time, your stroke can be treated. The warning signs of a stroke include sudden numbness or weakness of the face. If you experience this, call 911 immediately. Visit strokeassociation.org or call 1-888-4-STROKE today. A public service announcement from the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Thank you for listening to the Green Talk Network. Help to spread the green by involving your family and friends. You're doing your part. Now help them think green. Spread the green. The Green Talk Network.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Well, welcome back. You're with Bill Reed and John Becker, speaking with our guest today, Scott Horst from the U.S. Green Building Council. And Scott, right before the break, you had talked about the fact or the point that it's incumbent upon us as designers or folks making choices to not abdicate the responsibility of what's important to you or what's important to me as that designer. So,
let me amplify the question a bit. What I'm concerned about in hearing that statement, and I think many would be, is that what do you have to do with it? Isn't there an absolute issue here? And so what's our role in making these decisions, and how is it incumbent upon us to be part of this decision-making process? What does that mean, Scott?
Well, from my perspective, that's really a worldview question, and I clearly, personally, come down strongly in the idea or in the concept that we are part of this world, so it's the thing that we've all talked about a lot in the past, the difference between the role of the subject and the object. So the object or the world, maybe has to have some very specific numbers associated with it relative to what we know health will be. But I, as the subject, it's my world, and I need to make decisions that really guide what the role that I'm playing in that world, the impacts that I'm having, and the things that I can do to transform it to make it a place so my children's world is the one I want them to live in.
And may I add some things to that, Scott? And please interject if I'm putting words in your mouth, but I would say that we can only really add things in the world in the places we live, in the places we understand. The world's a big place.
Mm-hmm.
So until we really start grounding ourselves in terms of what's meaningful to our community or the region within we live, I'm not sure we can make that decision very effectively. That's a statement. You can come back at me on that one.
Well, I think I can say that where I live, water is more important to me than carbon, or, you know, I might be able to make that kind of statement. The problem relative to this discussion we're having today is that the water might really be impacted someplace completely differently based on the materials I'm using in my place. Mm-hmm. So, but it's still up to me, basically, to say that climate, I mean, and we collectively say this stuff too. We're saying right now as a nation, I think, that climate matters. But we have to be careful that when we say that, we're also saying that something else doesn't matter as much.
May I make an analogy here that just struck me as you were saying this? When we're doing, when you're taking care of your own body, your medical, your health, the health of your body, there are different healing modalities that are useful. There's Western medicine, there's acupuncture, there's cranial sacral therapy, there's Rolfing, chiropractic, all those. It seems, and all of them are good in one way or another, it seems that you are required to make the right decisions for your own body. You can't depend on somebody else to give you an instruction book.
Exactly, exactly.
So what you're asking, what you're really suggesting is we all need to explore what then is important to us in making these subjective decisions, and in this, in the context of materials, but basically in the context of the whole green building movement.
Yes, absolutely, because I completely love the health analogy, because ultimately you're responsible for your health. The earth will take care of itself without us,
right?
But we're here as stewards, and that means we're responsible for our collective health.
And collective meaning all the brothers and sisters.
All people, all things.
All plants, all animals. Yeah, so that sounds so broad to people. And, you know, the only way you can begin to get a handle on that is to actually begin to feel and react to what's right. I know that sounds so squishy. There's numbers, and we're not trying to get rid of... I want to not making that statement. I don't want to say that data is not important.
Well, no, I think...
All this information is not important.
Really, Bill, what you're saying, I think, is pretty clear that one without the other is insufficient.
You know
you want to get in your car, or maybe this is a bad analogy, but you want to get in your car to go someplace, but if you don't have a speedometer, you don't know how fast you're going necessarily. You can feel it, but, like, so LCA is simply, you know, that kind of mechanism.
Yeah, we know how fast you're going.
That's good. I like that analogy, actually.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And there are times when you are actually not in touch with the feeling of the car, and you need that number. There's times when you're not paying attention.
Right.
Well, with that said, Scott, we want to thank you very much for the perspective you brought today and a lot of the clarity that I think you brought to this subject, and we appreciate your time, so thank you.
Thank you, guys. This is fun.
Appreciate it, Scott.
Wow, so where we ended up there was pretty interesting, right?
Yeah,
heavy. You know, we started off by talking about this sort of data-driven left-brain measurement tool and got over into the right brain realm of having to feel what's important to us and the pattern of our places.
Well, it's interesting that this requires us to... We can get lost in the speedometer, for instance, and not pay attention to the curve that's up ahead, you know, when we're driving a car.
Mm-hmm.
We can get lost in the details. And... You want to say something, John?
Well, no. I the same analogy worked with the medical piece, right? We could get lost in the dosage of the medicine we're taking without necessarily beginning to realize, well, we don't need that medicine anymore, or maybe we need to increase it at whatever, right?
Right. So what's needed is we need to take a step backwards. Higher, more open, larger perspective.
Oh, you're getting into another holonic perspective discussion, aren't you?
Yeah, well, for 2 minutes here, we're going to try to summarize.
Go for it.
So let's take an analogy of perspective. I'm going to take this from Eckhart Tolle's book, The New Earth. If you're on the planet, you know the sun rises and the sun sets.
If you're on the planet, right?
You're on the planet, but you take a step off the planet, go to the moon. The sun never sets.
Well, it depends where you are on the moon, actually.
What's
right?
that?
Well, it depends where you are on the moon.
Well, okay, let's say you're in a spaceship. But the basic idea is that your perspective has changed a whole dimension, an order of magnitude, so that the issues that you knew were immutable no longer are operative. And the point of that is that we also now are on the planet where it didn't matter what we did with materials. It didn't matter whether we cut off a couple mountaintops because there was enough resiliency on the planet to take care of it. Now we have a population and such incredible consumption that we are now abusing the planet to the point of potential destruction. So we need to take a bigger perspective, if you will, off the planet, figuratively off the planet. We're not leaving it, but we have to look at how do we start looking with all those pieces as a whole.
So then you're leading us into a different perspective of consciousness? Is that what
you're saying? Well, yeah. I mean that's so whatever consciousness means, let's not go woo-woo-ish here. You've got to be conscious of many things.
Right, because life's not technical.
Right.
Well, right?
Yeah, I mean, you put all those numbers together, you still don't have the right answer for concrete. You got to look at more things and many things. You can never look at them all together. You have to look at them with some other eye. And that eye is how you feel about it. I mean, that's where Scott was going. What's important to you? And at some point, this gets energetic. And now let me use a quick analogy. When you walk in a conference room, just to show you how real this is not woo-woo-ish, when you walk in a conference room after there's been a very violent discussion, and when you open that door to that conference room, what do you feel?
Ooh, someone was just really mad in there.
Yeah, you feel it. You feel something. There's no sign on the wall saying there was an argument in here. You know there was because of all that energy in the room. Mm-hmm. We need to be in touch at a different level.
And in fact, most of our education teaches us not to do that formally, yet we all can do it.
And we all know to do it, and we all know how to recognize it. So next week's meeting, whatever we're doing here.
Program, show.
Program is we are going to be talking about the role of being conscious.
And we're calling that the fifth universal element. So let's say goodbye.
Goodbye. On that note, John,
later on. We need to remind everyone that to do different things, we need to do things differently.
And to do things differently, we need to think about them differently.
And of course, to think differently, we need to be different.
And next week's about that being. See you next week.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. Please join us again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Green Talk Network, and make it a great and greener weekend.